Okay, so welcome to the Bus Stop Theater and to the Queer Acts Theater Festival, hosting an event called Looking Back at Queer Halifax. So my name is Kevin Kindred. I've been involved in a bunch of queer activism stuff in Halifax over the last decade-ish or so. Jen was telling me we could have called this discussion The Usual Suspects, because you're seeing in front of you a bunch of people who've been involved in a bunch of stuff over the years. So what we're doing here today, this event, I wanted to pull something together to talk about queer history in Halifax and in Nova Scotia in connection with the Gottesgen Street Gathering, which Pride is doing for the first time. You'll notice outside there's all sorts of little community groups who have booths, and you can get some lemonade from Queer Acts and a bunch of stuff. And their intention was to have an event that really allows community groups to focus on whatever their issues of the day are, and to talk to people, and to kind of use this as a community building event. So I wanted to make sure there was something that had to do with queer history as part of that gathering. And this is what we've sort of put together. I'm going to tell you, the format is, as I've tried to emphasize to all of the participants, very loose and informal. we're sort of experimenting with queer conversation about history. I think it will go in a lot of different directions. There's some focal points that I want to have, but this is not like going to be the definitive narrative of queer history in Nova Scotia. But we've got a bunch of people who have some great perspectives based on their background, and we're just going to start a conversation and see where it goes. There are a couple of reasons to do this. I hope people feel like being connected to our history is important. We're also going to we're recording this, and we're going to use this discussion possibly as a jumping off point for some things that queer acts might want to do in terms of performance somewhere down the road. So not quite sure what that's going to look like, but that's one of the other purposes of doing this today. And it is going to be very casual, so people are welcome to come, stay for as long as they like, leave if you'd like to go off and try something else. We're going to be here until 5, chatting in that kind of really casual way. To start, I told each of our panelists, or each of our participants in the discussion, I gave them about 2 minutes notice that I was going to ask them to explain who they are. So they're going to give us their name and about like 1 minute of their involvement in the community and in Nova Scotia, sort of who they are. Each of them could spend an hour or more answering just that question. So we're going to try real hard to keep that part to a minute. And then after that, I'm going to moderate this discussion. Just going to use some jumping off points to make sure everybody gets a chance to tell some of the stories that I know that are important to them. We're also very open to participation. So if there's a topic that we're talking about that you have something to say about because you were there or know a little bit about, then let us know. You can be part of this too. If you've got questions, that's great. We can incorporate that as well. It might be better to wait till like the second-ish hour for that to just make sure that everyone's had a chance to say a little bit yet until we shift to participation. But you know, we'll take that very casually. And on our way in the door is our final participant. So he has no idea what's going to come because he missed all of that introductory stuff that I just told you guys. All right, so enough from me for a little while. I'm going to pass the mic down. I think I mentioned everybody, but just so that Robin knows too. Because it's being recorded, it's great if you can speak into the mic if possible. It's not going to be 100% mandatory and we'll still get your voice otherwise, but if you're speaking, try to make sure there's a mic roughly close to your face. Okay, with no further ado, I'm going to let Jen introduce herself first.
Hi, my name is Jen. My association with this community started back in 94. I moved back to Halifax from the wilds of Prince Edward Island, where I had been marooned for the previous 12 years. And to put it in context, this was pre-internet days. I was unhappy, closeted, very angry, trying to find my community. And my connection to the community was the phone line that the queer community maintained at the time called Gayline. And it took me 2 months to screw up enough courage to call them. And I did that in a desperate search for community. I ended up speaking to a very nice young man on the phone for a while, and he didn't know what to do with me because I was coming to the community as a trans person. And at that time, there was no trans community. So ironically, I came looking for help, got passed off to the drag queens, who did, gave me some fashion advice and pushed me out the door and helped me out to get started. But very quickly, I ended up becoming the trans community, forming a local, the first trans support group in Nova Scotia, becoming an activist and getting involved, and I've sort of stayed involved since then. For me, it was a very weird experience coming looking for a community, finding it didn't exist, and having to start build it. And I guess my perspective is 20-some years on, although there is a large presence and lots of trans groups in this community, I still think that as a section or a subset of the queer community, we're still trying to find our place within this community, and maybe to some level that hasn't happened. So it's an ongoing process. So I guess that's sort of my sort of left-handed perspective of finding my way into the community. Although I have to be said at the end, I'm glad it was here because I came from a place of being very horribly alone, and even though I had to sort of build a community, at least there was a structure there to be, try to be part of. So that was important.
And just not to interrupt, please do feel free to come in. There's plenty of seats. You can come and leave as you like. So don't worry about coming in from the lobby if you'd like to come join us.
We're just going to say, hey, you're late every time you walk by, but that's okay. Hello, my name is Michael Davies Cole. Again, part of my story kind of echoes Jen, because I remember that original group, five of us? But
it may have been six.
Yeah, might have been. For me, I am originally from Nova Scotia. I have moved away for a long time, and when I came back, I was amazed that the queer community here wasn't what I left behind in Toronto. And then, just like as Jen spoke, but I went looking for my community. And I did find the trans community, as small as we were. But of course, this was in the days where nobody even knew what the word trans meant. And it was interesting because as long as I kept looking for my community and looking for my community, I would find people that were sort of like me. And one of the big things that was not here in a community was people of color that were out. In Nova Scotia, usually the history of people of color is you come out and you leave. Like, hi, I'm queer, goodbye, and take off. And so it was very hard, and I was sort of like always on the outside of every group I was with because there really was no one that could, speak to exactly how I felt being within that space because predominantly the groups were still all not of color. I found Halifax very interesting, and the Maritimes totally interesting, as queer history. I was on Halifax Pride Board for way longer than I really wanted to be, thanks, Dan, and Hugo. And I was involved early in NSRAP, and I think I went through all of the alphabet and have been on every group, and predominantly the part of the reason was because I was one of the few queer people of color, so it was sort of like, the go-to name, which was fine and good, very tiresome at points, but it was very interesting being here and being queer, let's do a rhyme, and a person of color at the same time.
My name is Hugo. I moved back to Nova Scotia from Toronto in 2004. I volunteered for Halifax Pride that year. The next year I co-chaired with Patrick Daigle, and twice more I was a sole chair of Halifax Pride. I was the first executive director of the Nova Scotia Rainbow Action Project. I was a former gay men's health coordinator at the AIDS Coalition of Nova Scotia. I helped to found the Queer Acts Theater Festival that Adam Reed is now doing such a superb job with, and which is helping to present this event today. I was a co-founder of Rainbow Refugees Association of Nova Scotia, and I was also a towel boy at Sea Dogs. Gay, 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 gay.
You broke the mic.
I'm done.
Wow. Can we write that down for prosperity?
That was the quickest speech I've ever heard Hugo give. My name is Rosie Porter. Unlike, I think, many people here, I grew up here, and I went to high school at QE. I came out when I was 15, so I had kind of an interesting experience of being a gay teenager 34 years ago in Halifax, and my first association with the gay community here, I would say, is Rumors across from Tex Park. The first time I went there, I was 15. They kind of had a policy of if you somehow got a membership card, they didn't really ask you much more. And that was kind of my community for
a lot. The statute of limitations.
Yeah. For I don't think the license is still around or anything like that. So for much of my high school years, that was kind of the center of my social activity. And I really loved Rumors. It was kind of like somebody's rec room. Everybody helped out, and they had stage shows and stuff like that. And, you know, looking back, it was a great sense of community for me. So I really enjoyed having that during my high school years. There was a youth gathering group that met on Macara Street. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But I wasn't really so involved with them. I went away to university and I did a lot of activism then, like participating in kiss-ins in Montreal and things like that. And then when I came back, I guess I would say that I got involved in Peggy's Film Festival. That was probably my first kind of reintroduction. And eventually I worked at AIDS Nova Scotia. And then later when AIDS Nova Scotia merged with the Persons with AIDS Coalition, which is now the AIDS Coalition of Nova Scotia, I was involved in that. I've sat on the Pride Board. I don't know, I can't think of... I'm sure there are other things that will come out in the discussion. But yeah, I've found Halifax to be a very embracing community for me. And I know that I certainly speak as a person of white privilege, I would say. And I was really lucky because my family was fine with me being gay. And that was in the early 80s. So that was a pretty big thing for me in terms of support.
My name is Daniel McKay. I came out in Halifax in 1983 after moving here to go to university a couple of years earlier.
When you were 5 years old.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Like Rosie, my first experience was with Rumors, and one of the earliest things that I did was help build the Rumors on Granville Street. So I got connected to the community that way. When the media in Halifax introduces me, they say that I'm an activist, but I'm really not. What I really am is a publisher, and that's what I've spent most of my time in the queer community in Halifax doing, meaning that I don't write a lot of stuff, meaning that I try to connect writers with an audience with money. That's the intersection of that Zen Venn diagram is what a publisher does. And so what I've tried to do for 30 years or so is ring out writers writing news largely with and get that on in ink on paper and now on the web. I was publisher of Waves magazine from about the when it was the Gazette in the 1980s until we stopped print a few years ago. So that's 10 issues a year for 20 or 25 years. millions of words, thousands of stories that form a really great storytelling of our of this chunk of history anyway. My current project is to publish a historical encyclopedia for Halifax. So that's always hungry for content. So I love, and it has a place to put everything. And so what I'm doing is working with a lot of writers and people who are doing history. So I'm not exactly a historian either. One of my jobs is to encourage people to write history and for me to get that out to people who are going to be reading it and who want to see it. I also have a really terrible memory. That's one of the reasons I'm not a historian. And that's why I have this by my side, because I can refer to, if someone has a question about the community sometime in the last 40 years, there's very likely an answer to it in the Halifax Rainbow Encyclopedia. That's why I have that by my side.
Thank you, Dan. I'm Robin Metcalf, and first I'd like to apologize for arriving late. We just drove in from Sheet Harbor, and I think I may be the longest out person here, which means I could tell you anything and nobody would know if I was lying. And I sort of feel like I saw this gas cloud kind of come together into clumps that came to be called LGBTQ, et cetera, early in the formation of the universe. I came out in 1974, and I was actually at that point living in Edmonton, although I'm from here. Not from Halifax specifically. I'm Atlantic Canadian, generic Atlantic Canadian, Newfoundlander, Acadian mix, and grew up all over Atlantic Canada, but I consider Halifax home. So I was living in Edmonton for a year, and that's when I came out, and then I came back to Halifax and looked for some kind of community, and unfortunately, at the point I was looking, the Gay Alliance for Equality, which had recently formed, it formed informally a couple of years earlier in 72 and was incorporated in 73, or registered as a society. But in 74, they had, 74, 75, they had a bit of a blip, maybe 6 months or so, and they weren't meeting, and that was when I was trying to get a hold of them. And I do have to tell you a coming out story about that, which is I managed in Montreal at a gay community center there. I was working for the railroad as a sleeping car porter, and they had a copy of a newsletter from the Gay Alliance for Equality, and it was a big issue on sexually transmitted diseases. And most of the articles weren't signed, but a couple were signed, Valerie Dalrymple. And believe it or not, there were actually three people in the Halifax Dartmouth phone book who might have been Valerie Dalrymple, all whom I called and all who were very puzzled by this call. And then I realized, oh yes, the issue is about VD. But then I found that the GEAE was holding events at the Unitarian Universalist Church on English Street, and I called up the minister there. And I do want to give a shout out to the Universalist Unitarian Church, because they were the first non-gay organization in Halifax, maybe the second after the 13th Tribe Motorcycle Club, that actually gave space to and support to queer organizations. So unlike Dan, I actually am a historian, not by profession, but by training and by vocation. And I have written most of this book, or much of it, with some help from some other people, which gives a sort of social history of Halifax. So I'm going to read the book. That's issue one. Issue two is, that's from 1997. The second edition is from 2014. So, quickly, I got involved in the Gay Alliance for Equality, plunged in the deep end, almost immediately presented a brief to a joint parliamentary committee, went to a conference in Ottawa in 1975, was photographed carrying the wrong placard, the one for St. John's, Newfoundland, and appeared on the front cover of the Body Politic. This all happened within a matter of several weeks. And when I came out, I knew I'd have to come out all the way. So I was Halifax's official homosexual for the late 70s, because I was the one person who would put his name in the paper and let his picture be taken. I didn't hold that position forever, but I was the first one, I think, to have that position. So I took a couple of turns chairing the Gay Alliance for Equality equality. I, with Georgina Chambers, I co-coordinated the 1978 National Conference that was here, and I was active in the national movement. I wrote for The Body Politic. I was working on the railroad for 10 years, but ended that in 85, and then wrote full-time, initially for the queer press internationally, and was publishing erotic fiction in magazines like Mandate and Honcho and Blue Boy, which give you an idea how poorly that paid. I found I was making more money writing about art in Canada, which I don't recommend as a means of getting rich either. So yeah, I've been a cultural activist and a political activist and a community historian. I have also been a publisher. I was one of the part of a collective that published a periodical called Making Waves, an Atlantic quarterly for lesbians and gay men. And I'm trying to think. Now I run an art gallery at St. Mary's University, and although the first exhibition of gay art that I was involved in organizing was in 1978, and then James McSwain and I organized a number of Art by Gay Men shows in, during the 1980s. So there's lots more to tell, but that gives you an idea of where I'm coming from, and I'm going to hand this over to Duma.
Who was checking to see if he was in the book? I noticed that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was doing. I was checking to see whether I'm in the book or not. Actually, my name is Duma, Duma Young, and I guess in some ways I came out around 1978, 79, even though I'm fairly young. My last name is Young, by the way. That's a joke. Okay. Robin might have been Halifax's official fag. I was Cape Breton official fag. And the reason why that happened was there was a murder in Cape Breton, and they were dragging gay men out of their homes and outing them, and the police were doing that. And me and another lesbian, we weren't on the list, and we demanded to be on the list, and we presented ourselves to be arrested. And that started my little career in activism at the time. So they threw us out. They wouldn't arrest us, and we later found out why, because our names weren't on the list type of thing. Anyways, I started coming to Halifax back in 1980, and Robin might have been the porter. I would jump on the trains. On the trains, I don't know, many of you don't know that there's a fare called Indian Fare. If you're an Indian, that's, you get a discount, or a First Nation person, Indigenous person, it's called Indian Fare. If I go down to the VA rail station, I would still get that today. It's 40% off. But there's a hitch at your stop in Grand Narrows. They don't actually stop. You have to jump off. It's true. Anyway, you kind of slow down, but that's the way it is, right? So you kind of... And I would come to Halifax, and I remember 1980, I think it was 1981, my cousins were going to Dal, and I wasn't old enough. I was about 14, 15. And I would go to Dal and go to the sub. And I remember one year, there was they used to stamp you red for underage and green for drinkable. You know? I always tried to get the green one, but never did. Right? But they had a winter carnival, and the queen was crowned, and the queen was a man. I remember that year. No, that was the thing. And it was the students at the Dell didn't seem to blink or didn't think nothing. And so I started hanging out with Dell, and later on it became, Gays and Lesbians at Dalhousie. And then I formally moved here to Halifax around 1984, 85, you know, and became involved. And I wasn't at Rumors because they wouldn't let me in. I never found out about the membership cards, or the membership cards were too expensive in a way, right? No. But you had to sign in with names, and there was a lot of politicians' names that were always on there, you know. But I did a lot of things, you know, in a way. I mean, like everybody here, you know, some things... If I remember them, if I will. And this is kind of my old stomping grounds in Scottian Street here. And I have a lot of friends. And a lot of folks have also died along the way, too. And that's what I also want to say, that we forget the history of the cost of the struggle here. You know.
Hi, my name is Lynn Murphy. Had nowhere to start, eh? Well, over the years, I chaired the Gay Alliance for Equality and chaired Pride Week. And as a member of the Atlantic History and Archives Network, which it consisted of like about four people, and when Robin was one of them. And there you go, that's four, that's the whole group. When Gala folded, all the papers of the club and of Gala were in a kind of cubbyhole at Rumors, and so Atlantic History and Archives Network constituted itself as a possible rescuer, and at the last meeting of Gala, we were empowered to take those records away and put them in a safe place until they could be donated to an appropriate, what do you call it, repository. And so all those records were lifted out, hidden away in my basement, and in due course went to the Public Archives of Nova Scotia, which is called something else now. For the past 6 years, my chief involvement in the community has been as a member of Elderberries, which is a group of LGBT seniors and our families, friends, and supporters. That's it. That's nothing.
Well, I know that's not it. I know you could have gone on a lot longer. So look, first of all, this is what happens when you ask these people to give 1 minute on their background, right? So think what we're in for now. No, thank you very much. I can't imagine like a group of people that I'm more interested in hearing your wide and varied perspectives on the history, queer history in Halifax and Nova Scotia. So if you've just joined us and a bunch of people have sort of been in and out, just to kind of reiterate, we're doing a very casual format here. I've got some like general questions that I'm going to ask. Mostly I just want to give these people a chance to chat about whatever they want to say. And you should feel free to pick up and come in and out as you want. If there's anybody in the lobby who's looking to come in, it's very casual. You can come in at any point that you'd like and you can stay for as long as you'd like. We'll be going till about 5 o'clock. Okay. So my first sort of jumping off point, when we were all collectively discussing by email how to organize this, I think you were all various levels of frustrated with how disorganized I was with my thinking about the event. But one approach that we landed on was to talk about sort of the geography of the queer history of Halifax and Nova Scotia. And I thought a nice spot to start that might be just to talk about Gottigen Street as a queer community or as part of the queer community, because you know we're here on Gottigen Street. It's the Gottigen Street Gathering, the first successfully hosted Gottigen Street Gathering by Pride. And Gottigen Street is obviously a very interesting, dynamic, multifaceted part of the community here that touches on a lot of other sub-communities in Halifax and a lot of the intersections of them. So I think of Gottigen Street as a queer area because in my time in Halifax, there have been a lot of queer businesses and gathering spots here. We've had a bathhouse here for most of the time that I've been here and at least like one or two queer bars at any time. So I'm just wondering, from your collective perspective, sort of what's the start of that or what's the older part of that history? There was some talk about Rumors. I know there's a Gottigen Street connection there too. But that's sort of where I want to jump in. So how far back or what's the starting point of Gottigen being a center of the queer community in Halifax? Or at whatever point do you sort of have something to say about Gottigen as part of the queer community in Halifax?
Well, institutionally, I'd say that the start was probably when Rumors opened on Gottigen, because before that, most of the social places were downtown. Like I mentioned the 13th Tribe, who actually did rent a space for a dance in something like 1971, and that was down in what's now the campus of NASCAD, the metal shop. But then the first clubs were in the Green Lantern building, and David's Club, and there were other clubs as well, like KJ's. And then the Turret opened across the street in the what's now called the Khyber Building in 1976. And it moved in 83, I believe, but that was down to Granville Street. And then it moved in, I don't remember the exact year, it was mid-80s. 85, 87? Chris says 87. I trust Chris. As you said, you don't remember things well. 87, it opened in the former... Well, Club Flamingo had been a couple places. I think it was also down in the Maritime Mall at one point.
Pub Flamingo.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was going to say it was originally the Vogue Cinema and then was called The Cove. And so that's my memory of the first institutional connection.
Okay. And what was the name of the first place that was established? This was when Rumors moved here. Yeah, okay. It was Rumors at that time. So there's a whole, and look, Dan has referred to the gay HFX. It's sort of a wiki page, really, that is has a huge history project connected to it.
It's a big encyclopedia.
Yeah.
So there's a page there, just like the Wikipedia. There's a page there for every person, place, thing, event that has gone on with queer community in Halifax over the years. The oldest page is from 1892, when Oscar Wilde visited Halifax and stayed in stayed on 1882. Yes, that's right. A little older than that. The wiki wasn't around at that time, believe it or not. but we have entries from there and saying, well, you know, having Oscar Wilde stay here and you can go and stay in the room where he stayed while he was on a tour of North America on Queen Street at the what was called the Queen Street Inn, now called the Waverly Inn. Right.
I just have to interject and say that in the 1980s, early 1980s, I had sex in that same hotel.
Ew.
Drop the mic,
one.
Anyone else on that topic? Anyone else have sex with Hugo in that hotel room? Oh, no? Okay.
So if you want to dive into the Halifax Rainbow Encyclopedia, you can just Google for that, or you can Google for gay Halifax and any topic, and you will almost certainly be dropped into the middle of that somewhere. But the URL is gay.hfxns.org.
And I was mentioning that just to say that, like, Robin went through a whole list of place names, each of which has its own history and has some of them just like little snippets at Gay Halifax, some of them like long stories. So there's lots of chance, if you hear anything that's of interest to you, there's lots of chance to follow up in your own research. All right. The question was, when did the Apollo open? And that's taking us to Barrington Street. And I think I'm just going to put a pin in that for a second, because I want to go towards Barrington Street in a little bit, too. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about Gottingen Street before we go there. So, sorry.
I guess I would like to talk about Rumors for a second, because when I moved back in February of 94, little did I know at the time that was the last 10 months Rumors was open. And I moved back here without my then loving wife and family, and I was alone for about 6 months. So that summer was essentially for me my coming out with the help of the local drag queens, and I got a lesson in how small Halifax was. So maybe I can share this little anecdote with you is that one of my first times out as Jen was in the club at Rumors, and might have been my second or third time there, and lo and behold, didn't I see one of the then prominent drag queens in Halifax who was a cousin to my ex-wife. And this person was a fairly nice person, but had one of the biggest mouths on the east coast of North America. And I was here by myself and not out. And it was one of the many sort of, you know, you have a flight or fight response. It's like, what the fuck am I going to do now? So I kind of screwed up my courage and went up and had a chat with this person. And then when he picked his jaw up off the floor, we had a chat. I have to give him some thanks, though, that up until the time I outed myself, he did keep my confidence. And that was one of the, you know, the things that I think I treasure from the community is that there were people along the way who did not have to go out of their way, did not have to keep my confidence, did not have to give me a little helping hand. And although I was very much alone, I look back at that as one of those little moments where someone gave me that little bit of a hand that I needed that allowed me to make that next step, because I really didn't know where the hell I was going and what I was doing at that time, because it took me another 7 or 8 years before I screwed up my courage and decided to transition and come out at work. And little did I know, that was among the first that had never happened here in Halifax. And I was kind of paving more trail than I had really planned on. But thankfully, there was just enough of a community and enough of a group of people who kind of gave me a little bit of help here and there that allowed me to exist and to move forward. So for me, I look back, although rumors and maybe the community at the time was in the process of imploding, there was still enough of a community that we were still helping each other out and a nucleus that we could move forward with. So I look back at that in some ways, although it was not a great time for the community, I do have some fond memories of the community and the people at the time, because without that, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, Dan. We had a question about the Apollo, and there's a big page in the Apollo, so I'll just quickly burn through that. Built in 1911 as the YMCA for Halifax. And in the 70s, in the early 70s, it was a straight bath. It was a place for straights to go for sex. The original owner died in 1974, and from 74 to about 2005.
Can I just say the look on Lynn's face right now is telling me, like, this is the first time you've heard that straight people have sex.
'74 became gay only and closed in 2005. And probably one of the most touching stories about the Apollo that we have recorded is that they had a Christmas Eve dinner. They had a Christmas dinner for the regulars who didn't have a place to go for to go home to their families. And so, it gives you very much an idea that the people who went there felt like this was a community and was a not just a place to go and have sex, but a place to hang out and to hang out with friends. Okay. That's it for the Apollo. For lots more detail, drop into the encyclopedia.
That's great. I mean, that kind of picks up on one of the things that I wanted to ask about rumors and about Gottingen too, which is, like, we think of these spaces as sort of unifunctional, like they're like a bar is a bar, and a library is a library, and a bookstore is a bookstore. But one of the things we learn about queer spaces that serve the queer community is that they serve multifunctions, so that a bathhouse is a community center, and a bar is a center for activism, and there's a lot more of that kind of where when people come together, the place starts serving multiple functions as well. So I'm going to actually hand it over to Michael, because you wanted to talk a bit more about Gottingen Street, and then I see Robin wanting to talk as well.
I just wanted to talk about, and I think you segued right into it, about when you talk about Gottingen Street and you talk about, you know, when it first was a queer area or whatever, I know a lot of there's push-pull every year about this being like the little mini-gay village and, you know, this group owns it or this group owns it or whatever. One of the unique things and kind of hardest things to deal with in Halifax is it's so small that communities literally end up on one on top of the other. So it's not like Toronto where you could have your own village and then your own space, and then Downsview can be like Jamaican, and then there's a group over here. So here we are literally have, and most of it is marginalized communities sitting one on top of the other. So we must respect the fact that this space has always, before it was a queer community, was a Black and First Nations community. The one issue with when it became a queer community was back then, a lot of what was missing was, you know, the people of color within the community. They were still there, like Walter was around.
Did I mention who Walter is?
Oh, Walter Borden. And actually, I'm actually going to say a story from my, I'm not speaking for him, but I'm going to speak of something that has always troubled me through my youth and growing up. Walter's my uncle. And just briefly, Walter Borden is Poet Laureate for Canada. He has won the Queen's Jubilee. He has won multiple awards. He did Tightrope Times back in, what was the date when he first did it here? The 70s? 1974. And like I said, soon after he did it, he had to leave. And part of it was because coming out, it was fine for queer white people to come to this area, but you couldn't come out as a queer black person because the black people in the area weren't happy with that. They figured we already had one strike against us, don't give us two. And it was the same as First Nations as well. It was like sort of, we already have something wrong, just keep that at home. What is interesting about Goderton Street is one of the pieces of history that has been lost, and I understand it's part of the person's own privacy, is we are home here from the UNIAC Square area to one of the first, I think she may be the first, fully transitioned trans woman in Canada, because they had to leave the country to have the surgery done because Canada wasn't even, the States wasn't even thinking on doing it. And this beautiful, beautiful woman of color. But so that kind of history gets lost when we were not included in the early marches and in the early struggle and an early fight. And it's like, we fought a fight so hard for the trans community back when, so quietly, got it done. And then years later, a float comes along going, let's fight this fight. It was like, hey, no. So I think when we lose pieces of history by excluding all of the things that we're setting on top of, we end up setting ourselves backwards each time because we're reinventing the wheel. Jen and I were just talking about the bathroom fight, and I said, we did that years ago. It was fun. Don't want to do that again. Ran around my piece of paper going, I'm allowed. But inclusion in Goderton Street. So I applaud having stuff on here. Yes, this is a gay village, and it's also the black village and the First Nations village. One time, these buildings were all owned by the Greeks. They had a very long establishment of Greek-owned areas in here. So, you know, just so that we keep that in perspective of its all-inclusiveness.
I did say Robin could go next, okay. But if you want.
Yeah.
It's really quick. I just want to say that picking up on what you said, Jen, about starting the group, and Michael, your participation, is that from small acorns, mighty oaks grow. And you've accomplished an enormous thing in starting that group all those years ago. It's enormous. It is. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, I wanted to pick up on the point that Kevin had made about spaces that were multi-purpose, because, of course, the first social places that I was aware of, places to go and drink and meet people in a queer context, were not queer spaces. They were general purpose, mainly straight bars where on a certain night or in a certain corner gay people would meet. So like when I was in high school, it was generally known that the Piccadilly Tavern, which was down on, let me see if I get this right. I think it, was it on?
Argyle, I think? I don't know.
Wasn't it on Argyle? It was above Argyle.
Okay.
I think it was Market. I'm trying to remember if it was Market or actually on Brunswick, where the that was the car dealership. Yeah, it was Market. Grafton. There we go. Grafton at Sackville, and I was never actually in the PIC, but I think it was still active as a gay place to go when I came out. I did go to the Heidelberg, which was just off of Spring Garden Road, was a German pub, you know, and I have a swizzle stick from the Heidelberg, and they sort of tolerated us, but we weren't allowed to make any shows of affection or dance together or anything like that, or we'd get kicked out. I should mention that the the Piccadilly, right?
Is that your show of affection? Yeah, okay. You're making up for lost time.
Right around the backside of the Piccadilly, which did face onto Argyle, there was a parking lot, and then there was steps that went up, and later there was London Rubber Stamp there. But in that space earlier, there was a men's clothing store called Matelot, which was very queer, and it was in the same building as the Piccadilly. And also the Dresden Arms, which is where David, what's the name of your apartment building?
Heritage Way.
On Artillery Place, right? It was on the corner of Artillery Place and Dresden Row, and that was also a place that people met.
That's the Triangle.
Yeah, and that bit of geography is called the Triangle, which was a major cruising area at the time.
So I have, I'm just going to grab, that leads me in a couple directions I wanted to go. I'm just trying to choose which one to go in, but I still want to talk about Gottesden Street a little bit first. So the questions I have floating a little bit, I mean, Tuma, you had said that Gottesden was your haunt, so I wanted to make sure, see if there's anything you wanted to say generally on the topic of Gottesden Street, and then also just so people can be thinking about, I want to talk a little bit more about rumors, because I think it's a really interesting kind of establishment, how it came to be, how it came to dissolve, et cetera. So.
Well, just picking up on what Michael was saying, I'll be honest, in my experience, Gottesden Street was not a queer neighborhood. It wasn't. People who are queer came to Gottesden Street. They came to just on the other side of Cornwallis. Very rarely would they come from here to Black Street. And then you would have what we termed the Lavender District, which was from Black Street to Bloomfield Street, and it was written up in Waves, actually, as an advertisement for a real estate company. That's how they marketed that area, where all the gays and lesbians lived, the Lavender District. But in and around this area, early on when I came here, just like almost 90% of all Mi'kmaq people, we came to Gottesden Street because of the Friendship Center. No. This is where we were. This was our community and stuff like that. And anytime the feeling was, when the group of Buddhists came and landed on Gottesden Street, it was like, why are these people here? Why are they coming to this area? I mean, you got to remember, it wasn't. This area is now quite changed in the last 20 to 30 years. It wasn't always like that. And then even before that, in 1940s, 50s, it was very an upscale, uptown area. This town is called Uptown, not the North End. The North End is past that way, Uptown. And this was and there was a bit of tension between having all these service organizations come here and dropping in. And the people in these communities here, we resisted having social service organizations here because you felt that it was just one more thing against, you know, people of for the Mi'kmaqs here, indigenous community here, and also for the Black community here, that it was felt that we were seen as the downtrodden, or almost seen to be moved into the ghetto, and then we see, and all sorts of other issues, and in some ways that was the perspective from what I received from the perspective of straight First Nations people here is like, you know. It was never really a queer area. This was like, queers came into the area, but it was like the neighborhood belonged to folks from Uniac Square, from down this here, Maitland Street, and up and around. And also, it was an area for poor people. You know? And so back in the early 1990s, when social organizations started coming around, people resisted. And they were complaining about the fact that, why? Do we need another needle exchange? Do we need another AIDS organization? Do we need another social? And people had those questions, and yes, we did. But that's. But if we're going back to the history, even before rumors came, there was the Club Flamingo, where underage kids were also exploring, I guess, you know, and queers and straights and everything. We all mixed in there. And for many First Nation people, it was the Friendship Center. That's where you went. And when I arrived, we came from all over Atlantic Canada, and there was about 15 to 20 gay and lesbian people there at the Friendship Center. And it was there for education, all the support services, you know, because we also knew that that was the safe place for us. And in some ways...
Sorry, can I just... Do you mean gay and lesbian Mi'kmaq people at the Friendship Center?
Gay and lesbian Mi'kmaq people, okay. Maliseet people, Inuit people, and folks who were indigenous coming off the ships. We had a lot of lesbian sailors, I guess, who came in, and men who were Inuit or from elsewhere. They wouldn't necessarily come to rumors. They would go to the Friendship Center first and ask, where is the gay community here? And so that's where there was about 20 of us there, that we were all there. But we would walk over to rumors, and sometimes I remember... There was a restaurant next to Rumors, and a guy eventually ended up opening up a bar upstairs. The Double Eagle, he had the Double Eagle on the door. Remember that guy? Yeah. And he actually got into trouble with some Russians or Ukrainians, and they smashed his door down for having that eagle on the door. I don't know, anyways. But that's the history of Gottingen Street here, and there's always been that issue. Like Michael was saying, there's all these intersectionality. So when you say the queering of Gottingen, that would be a very recent thing.
Okay. Well, I still want to pick up, because we've mentioned rumors a little, and I want to talk more about it. So some of you have had some involvement in rumors, and Rosie mentioned liking the place. I think a bunch of you have been there. I just think the origins of rumors, like where it came from as an establishment, is interesting compared to some other of the queer bars that we've that have come and gone over the. So does anyone want to pick up on that and tell some of that story? I see Lynn leaning in. I don't know if that's for the mic. Yeah.
Start with Robin.
Oh, okay.
Lynn was certainly part of this history, too. It really began with the turret, because in January of 1976, the Gay Alliance for Equality started holding dances in the top floor of the Khyber Building, as it's known, at 1588 Barrington, which was right across the street from David's Club. So people were going back and forth from one club to the other. But David's Club was a privately owned club. It wasn't licensed legally, and it was overwhelmingly men. When the Gay Alliance for Equality started the turret, it quickly became a regular, like we took over the space within 6 months, started renting it one night at a time, and it was extraordinarily popular. And I know of where that was open on a regular basis, where significant numbers of men and women. Equality, we ran it as a private members club, people were talking about what people signed in. There were an awful lot of people. We had an awful lot of visits from Mickey and Minnie Mouse and Judy Garland. And that space was also beloved. And we were there until, I think, 83. And then we moved down to Granville Street. And when we moved down to Granville, that's when we adopted the name Rumors. So this is the club run by the Gay Alliance for Equality. And it moved from Granville, still keeping the name Rumors, up to Gottingen. And Lynn, did you want to say?
The one thing, we didn't think it was unusual, but other people did. An unusual thing about the turret and rumors was that, first of all, we were owned by the community, and people would come here from the States or from other parts of Canada, but especially from the States. And the idea that it was run by the community, because in a lot of places in the States, the clubs were owned and run by organized crime. And the reason for that was they had lots of money to pay off the cops to prevent them from being raided. The cops never seemed all that interested in raiding rumors. But however, there we were. We were owned by the community, and also that we were from the first a mixed organization. A lot of places in other centers where it was a men's bar or it was a women's bar, and that was it. But we were always a mixed bar. I went to Boston one time, I can't remember when, probably in the 70s, maybe. And so before I went to Boston, I thought, well, I'm going to go to a bar that's up there. And so I looked in some guide to bars of Boston or whatever, and went into what was supposed to be a lesbian bar. Well, I had come into the community kind of through the ways of feminist organizations, right? And we were pretty kind of low-key. I get into this bar. Well, holy God. They all looked as though they had just stepped off their motorcycles, which might be, you know, beside them. And I was afraid of them. They were probably lovely women. I was too afraid to speak to them. So I drank my beer and went away.
That's the Liberian in you.
Yeah, that is.
as for rumors, it really was a wonderful space, I must say that, and it was really excellent. One of the things, in the introduction, I must say that I kind of pride myself on not, I mean, I guess I'm probably the only one here who hasn't sit on Pride, Halifax, or on Nova Scotia Rap, or on Gay Alliance for Equality.
How did you escape?
I fought every one of you. I was like, oh. Anyways, it really was like a safe space, but it was really also intriguing. You have to also remember, the times were a little bit different. And I remember with my friends, who were Mi'kmaq, and they didn't really want to be seen because the Friendship Center was just down the street. And Mi'kmaq people were walking up and down the street and everything, and they would also see who would be coming in and out. So at nighttime, then we would be going down to the palace or something like that, and then we would take a taxi cab, and my friends would say to the taxi cab driver, and they didn't really want the taxi cab driver to know where we were going to. They would say, take us to the corner of Creighton and Falkland Street. And then you had to go through Jack-off Alley, that alley, right? No, and then look around.
That is not a municipal name. That is a.
And then you had to look around and see who else was there, and then pop in, because it was very, you know, right on the street, right type of thing. And if there was a lineup, it was, you know, people were like, I'm not so sure. Hurry up, get them in. And I'm glad that, you know, that if Walter's your uncle, then Gloria's your aunt, right? And then Gloria would keep everybody, you know, as move them as fast as in, as possible, you know. And, but it did. It was really a safe space for everybody. It was kind of a community. And we were forced to mingle and get along in a way. Mind you, there was huge fights. And when you talked about the police not coming, I just mentioned over to Robin here when the one time the police came to rumors. Or they came for many times to kick somebody out or something like that. But they were called for the shirtlessness issue.
Oh, wow.
I had to bring that up.
Put a pin
right?
in that. I have a whole bunch of questions about that. So let's get there eventually.
That was a fun time, but, you know, it was a fun time. I wasn't part of that, but I do tell you, we were impacted by it. And you have to also understand here, and I might as well tell the story here. You know, the shirtlessness issue wasn't really my business. I was like, okay, fine, whatever is going on between these white folks and stuff like that. And that's really weird. And there was a dress code that was imposed about what a woman could not wear walking down the street in broad daylight down Gladian Street, a man cannot wear. Well, we wore tank tops. And the manager stopped a group of Mi'kmaq men and told us we couldn't go into rumors wearing tank tops. And we just saw this. And remember, this is in the context of the race riots here on Gladian Street that had just happened a few years ago. Before that, with black people not allowed into the palace, native people were not allowed in the palace wearing gold chains or anything African or anything res, you know. And dress codes were just a flashpoint for us, you know. So in some ways, the only people that weren't allowed into rumors were for wearing the dress code was native people. And I remember sending letters off to Gala. There was a woman there, I forget what she was, the president there, and we had letters flying back and forth trying to fix this issue. I think so, yeah. And then there was other areas too, don't forget that we also had Wormwood's Dog and Monkey Cinema that was down on Barrington Street, and they moved up to where the Propeller Brewery is right now.
They actually started on
Gladigan Street, Wormwood's, yeah.
Started where Propeller Brewery is now.
Yeah.
And then they went down to, they followed us to the old turret space, and then they followed us to the old end of the former Brewery space.
Yeah. And so that's where I first saw a lot of gay movies, and that was really the only place you can go and see them. You know? But rumors, and God love it, it was a wonderful time, and I really was very sad to see it implode, you know, or something like that. It just, sometimes we are our own worst enemies.
Michael, and then someone's going to have to talk about shirtlessness, so you decide who I'm going to ask that question.
I think Rosie
won. First,
okay.
Michael.
No, I just wanted, because a couple of things that Duma said made me think about, here was me trying to get to rumors. I came down from Toronto for a visit, and so I was used to the Rose, which is like lesbian only, and I was used to the, I used to go to Chaps, and I used to go to the Warehouse, and I found out much, many years later, that I got into those two places because everybody thought I was a drag queen, because they were men only, so that was funny. So, but when I came down here, people were like, oh yeah, well, Rumors can, anybody can go. So I ended up down by the Palace thinking I was going to Rumors, and I went in, and in Ontario bars, well, the bars I was used to, bathrooms were just bathrooms, and you went to whichever was closest. So I went to the closest one, which happened to be the men's room, and I didn't think anything about it, and I looked very, very feminine then, and they called the cops on me. So, yeah, they called, I didn't get it, like, they were going to arrest me, because I didn't know what I did wrong. So they put me out, and I'm like, then I found out that, no, I was not at the gay bar that I thought I was at. I was like, oh, I see, okay. And the cops very nicely pointed me in the direction, so I made it up to Rumors, got in there, and the whole thing about not signing your own name, so I'm getting in there, I'm so happy, you know, I'm with my people again. I'm signing my own name. This one queen sometimes goes, oh, girl, you do not put your own name down, honey. And I'm like, no, it's okay, it's okay. I'm out there, I'm out there, I'm out there. And then Gloria showed up. And I might add that I don't think I was really of legal age, see? And I was like, so, yeah, I'm not going to make it to end with the queer people today, am I? No. And I went home.
I just went, the shirtlessness stuff, I don't know, I was not involved in activism then, but I just wanted to say that along the lines of, I started going to Rumors when I was 15, and it was very much a community space, and it was very much a space where people supported one another, and there were, as you say, it was so small. There was intermingling, you know, there was a dance floor and a bar on the main level and two pool tables upstairs, and that was about it. It was a pretty small space. And I would say that when it moved up to Gottingen, I think having that building allowed for a lot more organizations to have meeting space. And there were meetings upstairs, and I remember very vividly seeing, I think Tightrope used to meet there, seeing a sling upstairs, and that was my first experience of that. But I think that because there were so many people mingling there, it was a really great space for political activism, and GAE held their meetings there, and Gala, and, you know, I certainly remember some things like when we protested about Simon Thwaites, I think we met there to do that. So it was a bar, but it was really important that it was owned by the community, and you really felt that. It was not just like a bar that was run for profit.
And Rosie, do you want to just mention the protest that you mentioned? Do you
want to
give a little bit
more about that? Oh, Simon Thwaites was a man who was, he was HIV positive, and he was about to retire, I believe, and I don't know all of the facts of this, but so somebody else can fill in. He was about to retire from the military and get benefits, and they let him go before he reached the limit, and it was something like a matter of months, I believe. So a bunch of us went down by where the bridge ramp is, where you go into the dockyards, and protested. And it was the first protest, I think, that I was ever at. And there was a lot of coverage, and we stopped traffic. And I remember Robin and James were there, very, very much demonstrating their homosexuality. And it was a lot of fun to be involved in that. I think that that was the first activist thing that I was ever involved in.
I don't know if you want to fill in more about that, anybody.
Yes, use the other mic.
Yeah, I was flashing that picture from the book because that's a picture of James Shedden at the dockyard demo for in support of Simon Thwaites, and very ably demonstrating his homosexuality there. If anybody wants to see it, you can look at this later. I was going to add a couple of things. One was, I know you want to talk about the shirtless war, but I wanted to mention, on terms of Gottingen Street, another point to remember is at Staticona, is on Gottesian Street. And Alan Berube, the American activist queer historian, has talked, written about San Francisco and about the U.S. under his book Coming Out Under Fire and the importance of the military for port cities like Halifax and San Francisco and the emergence of queer communities. And in both world wars, particularly World War II, the mass mobilization of young people, taking them away from their home communities and plopping them into all same-sex environments with the possibility they might be dead in 2 weeks, was a great incentive for discovering one's homosexuality. And a lot of people then settled in places where they'd been posted, and communities started there. I don't know much about the World War II and post culture of queers in the military in Halifax, but I do know I have heard there was a club called a cafe called the Bluebird, which was, I believe, down near the train station. And in the 40s, it was a place where queer servicemen would go and get picked up by other gay men. Should I plow into the?
I was going to ask if Lynn wanted to talk about shirtlessness. I don't know, is that in your area?
Oh, yes.
Well,
now, you are the official guard, okay? Because Robin and I were somewhat on the opposite sides of this issue.
You guys were on opposite sides on many issues, I remember. I remember we did that workshop at the Nova Scotia PWA on two-spirited people. That was during the second Pride March. And we talked about drag queens and Donald Marshall Jr.
I was shocked at
drag queens and Donald Marshall Jr. Okay.
Shirtlessness kind of eclipsed everything else. It started off, I think, because it was a hot summer. And the men, or some of the men, wanted to dance with their shirts off in the second Rumors, the Gottigan Street Rumors. And so they took their shirts off and danced. Well, there was a dress code. And the dress code did say, I think, that you were supposed to have a top. And the thing was, we thought, whether rightly or wrongly, that if the women took their shirts off, then the liquor license would be in danger. And so the women felt that, as a gesture of solidarity, that the men should continue to wear something on top, however skimpy, because we had to wear something on top. And then someone wrote a letter saying that, a woman wrote a letter saying she didn't want to be dancing beside Ben's hot, sweaty bodies. And then Robin wrote a letter, I think, saying the hot, sweaty bodies were a really good idea. Or words to that effect. And it all became mostly men versus women issue. And it blew up to the point where an alternative board was elected to we were the Gay and Lesbian Association of Nova Scotia by that point. And then came the first meeting, and the alternative board either resigned, or I forget what the story was on that. But it all blew up in a way that it needn't have blown up. We should have brought in some kind of outside conciliator to hold a discussion. The men and the women had been fairly opposed on drag a few years before, and we had lived through that, and the women mostly came around, actually, to seeing what the drag men were doing and that it was not insulting. to women. But the shirtlessness issue just became so involved with, I guess, a lot of other things. I don't know.
Well, the society didn't talk about anything else for an unpleasantly long time, and there was other stuff to talk about. We had to run a bar, and we had to run an organization, and we just stalled out on the topic.
Well, we didn't just stall out on it. We destroyed the organization, I think, effectively. Thank you, Lynn, for setting that up. I will say, Lynn and I have often had, vociferous arguments about things, but I've never felt like she was on the opposite side of when it came down to like basic struggles.
In the long run, when I cooled down, I started to feel that Robin was on the right side, and that we had had this huge argument and differences of opinion that became quite overheated. And really what it was about was fear that we would lose our liquor license and we would lose the club. Well, guys, we lost the club anyway. We might as well have been on the right side and said, everybody should be able to take their shirts off. And if the liquor license board wanted to come in and make an issue of it, we could have gone to the press. But I feel that I was on the wrong side.
I don't think there was any real right or wrong side, I'll be honest with you. But sometimes I think that's a lesson that we can all go forward is to, when we get so entrenched in our positions that we may invariably hurt ourselves, and not look out. And sometimes I see that what we're in the discussions, what the current issues are today, if we get so entrenched in our issues that we alienate ourselves and we lose a community space. And that really was what really happened is that we lost a very wonderful space, and it took a long, long time before, I'm not sure that we've ever regained it in some ways. And other areas now coming into force, and then we moved on from there. And there's, in our current discussions of intersectionality, many oppressions or many issues that are facing our communities, we have to think about, there's a quote that that I just heard, seen today from Justice Murray Sinclair about reconciliation. And he talks about us and this message was for First Nations people. And he said, we have to stop walking backwards. And at some point, we're going to have to turn around and see where is it that we're going to go. And that's sometimes we have to think about is that when we're looking at, what has happened to people or how is this or can we all get along in some sense, we have to stop that and turn and say, where is it that we want to go and how do we want to get there? And that has to be done together. And that's that inclusiveness. That's a fundamental principle of our queer activism all along. It's just that it could be like, at times I was like thinking, the shirtlessness issue never really bothered me in one sense. I never quite understood it in a way, but what did they argue? But it had a direct impact upon me in a way. And I just felt very annoyed and very upset over that in a way. Why should this impact upon me? But it impacted on the whole community in a way. So with that, but I just want to go back to the Gottigan Street thing. It wasn't just Gottigan Street. There were also other spots in and around this whole neighborhood. Maitland Street. There was Stepping Stone. It's there. And that was a safe spot for gays and lesbians. In fact, that's where a lot of spin-off on organization. That's where the first needle exchange occurred. And then the Friendship Center, our Deb, what's that street up where the needle exchange used to be up?
Owen or Agricola?
Agricola. It was on Agricola first, and then moved there. And then we also had the hostel, the youth hostel on Brunswick Street, where Dan was a fellow by the name of Dan and his partner, Michael Ware. They held, well, I guess what would be called conscientious raising circles on ACT UP and Queer Nation. And we all kind of, well, there was, well, I guess we were smoking clove cigarettes, you know. And part of that place, to support the shirtlessness, we gave the women ACT UP stickers to cover their nipples. So we would not lose the license, right? No. So, I mean, Dan and Michael Weir were there, and they had that eye thing. So that spot was a very meeting spot. And there was also Morton House on Brunswick Street.
Yes.
And I remember that. And this is how things can evolve and change. I want to tell you about Morton House. We did a poster campaign for Morton House and about HIV and AIDS. And you have to remember this, even with me being out and stuff like this, a good friend of mine, Marion, and she's now passed away, Marion, and she was from the, she used to live up the street here, Gottigan Street, on that corner there, across from Union Square.
Yes, Cornwallis or Charles. I mean, not Charles or Gerrish.
Gerrish,
it's funny day now, but it was Gerrish.
And two gay guys living here, Tony and Ron, used to live there. And they were part of the letter community, and I think they both passed away now. And we all kind of got along, and I lived up on Dunning Street by North Street there. And what happened there is, I forgot my train of thought now. What was I talking about?
Tony and Ron
and Marion. Oh, Marion. We did a photo shoot, and Marion would not let her face be shown on the camera in the poster, because she said the black community would think that she had AIDS.
Yes.
And even me, I would not let my full face be shown on the poster, just half of it, because the Mi'kmaq community would think I have AIDS.
Yes.
But we were all, they wanted diversity, and we, this is as far as we can go with it. I mean, even how old I was and everything like that, that was, you have to remember, those were different times.
Yes.
You know?
If we could, I just wanted to jump on when you were talking about the unfortunate impact of the t-shirt issue. And you say essentially that today, at that time, imploded the local queer community, set us back a bit. And my own experience in founding Atlantic Transgender in 96, we had a similar experience in around 2000. In terms of a debate with or a conflict between the cross-dressers in the group who were primarily straight-identified white men and the trans-identified people in the group that caused that community to implode. And what I see as an unfortunate thing going forward to this day is the queer community is a heterogeneous community. And I think we are still struggling with the idea of forming a true queer community at its core that has many branches. And I don't know that we've really gotten there. And that I think that we're going to limit ourselves and keep shooting ourselves in the foot until we wrap our heads around this, is that at our core, we're a minority, we're an oppressed group to some degree or other. And until we can truly come together as a queer community. And when I was introduced to that word and that concept, I think it's so brilliant as a concept, it has yet to be realized. And I keep seeing us, one way or another, shooting ourselves in the foot and going back to the homogeneous part of the queer community. You know, and I think we're so small in terms of the general population that we're not going to achieve our goals until we can kind of put our egos in our back pockets and say, hey, you know, we're all part of the same community, let's get the fuck on with it. Let's get it done. And I think that's, as I get older, that's a perspective I keep seeing. And maybe it's because I'm a little older now, it's because I keep seeing the same mistake happening over and over again. And I'm hoping that when we share our perspectives of having been there, done that, that maybe the younger folks moving forward can take that lesson and maybe, if not, you know, hit a home run, you know, hit a few singles, move the mark a little forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you said it perfectly, can't we all get along? Can't we come together?
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I think Robin has something to say, and I do see your hand at the back, and as soon as Robin said, I'll turn to you as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to fill in a bit more about the shirtless board, because we've talked a lot about the consequences, but to say a little bit more about how it emerged. And I agree with both of you that the ultimate result was a tragedy, and the issue of process and how people resolve differences is one of the key things to learn from that. I will say that it began earlier than, like Lynn said, that hot summer day. It was a hot summer day when things sort of moved to another level, but it had begun sometime earlier. First of all, in many clubs in North America, gay men danced with their shirts off. The dance culture was kind of a really crucial culture. It was an ecstatic culture, and taking your shirt off was part of being participating in that ecstatic dance culture. And it didn't happen in Halifax, even though we had a community-owned club. And part of that was because people felt like, well, if you're going to really party, you go to Montreal to party. You don't really do it here. And I don't know, it would be interesting to unearth exactly what policies were in place, but my memory, which may be faulty, is that it wasn't a matter of strict policy, it was more a matter of a general understanding. And Lynn has identified one of those things, which is the sense that, well, if women can't go shirtless, then there were two ways to say. One, if women went shirtless, they might lose their license. So there was a fear there. There was also an equity issue. If women can't go shirtless, then men should neither, which is an argument. And I was very much a partisan of this. I'm not a disinterested observer. But I felt like that's not a good reason to say, well, it's all okay if we make everybody equally oppressed. I felt, no, what you do is you look at the people who haven't got the freedom, and how do you get that freedom to them? But there was a group of men who started dancing with their shirts off the winter before all this happened. So it was in like November, December, and on through that winter. I was one of those people. Chris Boyne was one of those people in Cambalange, and we would even call each other up and say, are you going to take your shirt off? Because we needed this Saturday, because we needed moral support. But when we did it, it sort of created a little space in the dance floor, and other people started joining, other guys initially started joining that. What happened? In the meantime, ACT UP was organizing, and there was also a confrontation where ACT UP did an action at the club and seized the podium, seized the stage to in front of the largest video screen east of Montreal to tell people, you know, to confront the community and sort of challenge us and say, are you dealing with the issue? And as part of that, the screen apparently supposedly became damaged, and so there was at one point ACT UP was banned from the club, I believe, because of that. Anyway, it was Pride Day, it was a hot summer day, and during the march there were people going into sprinklers to get all wet in order to stay cool. And after the march, but before the night's dance, a group of women went and swam at a lake outside the city. And these were women who were active in ACT UP, and they decided they were going to take their shirts off. And they had this idea that if they kept their nipples covered, they'd be okay legally. And we all learned the word areola. And that's really ACT UP. I still have some of those stickers. I have a little roll of them. They put times equals get stickers on their nipples, covering their areolas. So it was around 1 o'clock in the morning, as I recall, they were waiting for a certain song to come on, and that song, it wasn't coming on, but then I think it was We Are Family that came on. And this group of women took all their shirts off, and the next 3 minutes were the best 3 minutes of my life. The women formed this kind of circle, and the men who were dancing, like we were dancing a shirtless circle. When we saw what the women were doing, we formed another circle around them, where one was going clockwise, another counterclockwise, and like within like, you know, a minute or two, half the people on the dance floor, men and women, taking their shirts off. It was an amazing moment of collective liberation of claiming in space. Now, I won't go into chapter verse what happened in the next few months, because a lot of things happened this way and that way. There were a lot of meetings, a lot of attempts to try to resolve this. Mm-hmm. Essentially, there was a fear that we might lose the space. Although we hired Maureen Shabib, who was a lawyer, to look into it, she said if they actually tried to arrest someone for taking their shirt off, that law would be overthrown, and it was overthrown, in fact, within like a year or so, and a woman in Guelph, Ontario. Yeah. And in fact, the signs that I saw was that the Liquor License Board and the police were actually not interested in the issue. They weren't inclined to, they sort of said, you take care of that yourself. They were happy for us to have a big queer club. We kept all the queers in one place. And so it was kind of a confrontation between, on the one hand, the kind of physical bodily liberation, and I always say that's very important. For me, that experiencing things in the body, like being in a march, you know, it changes. You're never are the same person again after you've been in a demonstration, and you've never the same person again after you've danced ecstatically with your shirt off with your community. So there was, my position was, we should claim that freedom. If there's a political fight, we fight it as a community so that we can all be free. And I will note that it came to a head because a group of women claimed the right to take their shirts off. So the whole struggle was very gendered, but it wasn't that the men were here and the women were there. There was men and women here and there was men and women there. There was also a certain amount of shaming of people for taking their shirts off. That was another, not all the people who were opposed to the shirtlessness were shaming people, but some were. And someone like Pam Leeming, who was the president, who I have great respect for, was trying to manage that, to keep things, people in conversation. We weren't able to resolve it, and through a number of meetings, things went down the toilet, and the organization basically fell off. The coalition, because we'd had, for almost 20 years, we had a coalition of, well, men and women, also an organization that I think is more diverse, was more diverse in terms of class. There were more working class people involved in KLIS for Equality than in most queer organizations in North America. And although I won't claim that people from diverse communities were had adequate voice there, I mean, I was aware of people from people of color and people of trans people of different communities who were part of that community. We managed our own space together. That space generated money that we used to pay for activists or pay for, at one point we had a community house called Radcliffe Hall, which was Lynn Murphy's idea for the name, on Macara Street. We published periodicals, we ran a gay line, and we sent delegates to conferences nationally and internationally on the basis of the money we made from the club. So we lost a lot when we lost that coalition, but it did fall apart through the shirt support.
Okay, I'm just going to go to the woman who had her hand up at the back. Who, your hand's not still up, so I can't see.
Yeah, no, mic. I don't need a mic. I'm pretty loud.
Yeah.
My name is Deborah, and I just want to say that for me, even before there was a community, okay, I'm 62 years old, so I will tell you that I don't like saying coming out because I don't ever remember being in. I was never raised in a home where we were taught that this was wrong and all of those kind of things, other than my mom saying, what's that in my living room? I said, she's a girl. But she has men's clothes on. I know. Well, what does that make her? I make her a girl that likes girls, mommy. So, well, what does that make you? I said, one of the girls she likes. This is my community. I've been in this community my whole life. I've traveled a lot. But I grew up in Uniac Square, I grew up in the community here, but I have to say that other than in a few places, because I lived next door to Men's Bar for like 9 years and I also make clothes, I make the apple covers for the drag queens and I do the hand beating on their dresses and stuff, I found it really hard to fit in even to the community. I did. I found it very hard as a woman of color to fit into the community, as a woman who identified as two-spirit or at that time bisexual. So people didn't understand that, you know, what they'd say to me, stuff like gay now, what is it, bi now, gay later, stuff like that. And I didn't understand that because all I knew about was the fact that I didn't ever identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, not really. I just said that if I had the opportunity to love someone from here up, what you have will work with, what you don't have will buy. So I always felt very blessed to be able to be that person, you know? So there's a lot of stuff that I can't get. I can't get. I mean, I was there. I was away with the frontline raw burners. Myself, someone's going to see my tits on charge in them. Which was a little different for me, too. You know, but I can say that from what I've seen in the community myself and the growth of the community here, that even though there's been steps back, even there's been some separations, that we've grown. We're growing. We're growing a lot. We're starting to feel now, as people of color more and of people who don't identify, say, as a letter or something, that we're starting to feel more comfortable. Like, there was a time when walking into, I went to Rumors, I actually went to the Turret, too, and I think, I mean, I might have been one of three women that actually went to the Turret, but when I went to in Montreal, I actually was asked to leave because I still had female genitalia, and this was a guy's bar, so I had to leave, and I don't. For me, I find that very upsetting. I find it really upsetting when transgender females are not invited to women's dances because the women's group don't actually consider them to be women because of genitalia. I think we need to get away from all of that. I think we're growing, and I think it's not your genitalia, it's who you, how you identify, and the fact that, I can tell you, I had a fire. I lost everything on Falkland Street, and I belong to a lot of communities. I'm Aboriginal, I'm Black, you know, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But the only community that did come out for me at that time was the community of the Blue Moon and Men's Month. Now, however they choose to identify, but the people that were there. The drag sisters put on a drag show for me. Yep. They showed up at my house with furniture and clothes and all of those things. And that's what I mean about feeling welcomed within the community. And I know I'm not the only person. My two cousins were actually the first transgender females in Halifax. You know, they had to go away, have their surgeries done, and come here. They're very out with themselves and open about it now. My friend Louie was one of the first people that actually was, and rest his soul, was at the hostel when it was on Brunswick Street. There was Louie and another person who's still with us, so I won't say their name. But I remember seeing Louie and them coming up the hill from the hostel, you know, to the community and stuff. Like, I mean, we're kind of, as people of color, we've kind of always kind of stayed on the outskirts a little bit. Even in the room, like, there's a difference. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that this community is so close to our own community. Now, myself, personally, I don't give a shit. They can get you, you know, I don't care. At 60-some years old, what are you, you know? But within the community, being the Black community there, that, yes, I still have to work with my own community to make them know that there's a lot more acceptance, so people are just people. I lost my partner in 91 from complications with HIV, but prior to that, I did take care of people physically. I actually went back to school so that I could learn how to take care of people who were getting too sick and were treated badly, and they couldn't go, North wouldn't take them, and Abbey Lane wouldn't take them. In our community, it was so secretive that everyone started dying with asthma. So, right, people were dying with asthma. We wouldn't talk about, you know, I was very blessed. My partner was one of the first ones to say in lieu of flowers, donations be made to the AIDS Coalition. You know, and I happened to be in partnership with a man at that time, a male, so, and he was one of the first people. So I think watching as many back steps as we've taken, I have to applaud everybody. I have to applaud everybody in this room, everybody on the panel, because you've all done a little bit here and a little bit, and that's all it takes. Everybody does a little bit. You know, everybody does a little bit, and that's, you think about 50 years ago, here on this street, do you think this right now would be happening? No, so I think we need to applaud everybody and ourselves, you know, and just keep working towards, like, again, they were doing a song up there and talking about unity, and I think that's what's really important, is to continue on with the unity, and I applaud everybody for it.
So I have, Michael wants to say something, and there's someone else from the audience who wants to say something. I'm just going to note in terms of time, it's 4:45, and we really do need to wrap up at 5, just because there's a theater show starting here at 6, so I'm going to try and be pretty really strict about that.
I told that we can go all night. Really?
Yeah. That may not have been me.
Don't leave my desk. I just wanted to say one thing, actually, and
when I did come to the screening and I couldn't find anybody of color, I really couldn't connect, that was my rock star. Because I knew one time going downtown, like going down to Energy down there, and I was the only person of color out with the queer group, and somebody was talking to me, and I heard this voice yelling that, "Don't be hassling that person, that's my friend!" That was my backup. But I did want to say about the thing about what you brought up about the trans, you know, trans women, that, and because I think Jen and I had the lovely experience of not, of neither one being allowed to go to a trans woman or to a woman's event because neither one of us fit the bill, and we still are not quite sure what that bill was. But anyhow, and so it is great to see that those things have changed. They haven't changed enough, but they are changing. And that's what we need to keep our eye on. And the fact that when we say community, that we recognize that everybody has a different version of what that word means. So when we say our community is growing, I think we should actually, every time we say that, we should take 2 seconds, pause, and think of everybody's community growing. And that just, we cannot just let it go one way.
Okay, I'm going to go to someone in the audience who's with us, and then to my computer. No, sorry.
Hey. I started at a young age, and I love people. I'm a people person. I love everybody. Forgive me. Really, I do. And I went to the Torrid, and I used to go to every bar of the year, Rose Club, and I didn't really care where it went. Really, who was there? I just cared that there were people. And pretty much, I really didn't say, oh, this hurt. You know what I mean? I didn't put any thought of anybody thinking anything bad of me, or if I went here, or if I went there. Or,
yeah.
I know. We're all human.
I think it's been great that, like, some of this, what these folks have said about how the different forms of inclusiveness, where different sorts of people feel like it's been open. And it's also important to recall when we say inclusive that it's never entirely all-encompassing, that even that inclusiveness, there have been some people more on the margins and some people more feel incredibly inclusiveness. Sorry, I didn't mean to take the mic.
I was just saying I'm a heterosexual back then and still now, and I really don't care what people think of me, really. I went to the tour and someone said, "Are you gay?" I said, "Well, whatever you think." Look at that. I really don't care what you think, to tell you the truth. I'm here, and this is me. You know what I mean? Like, don't label somebody, and don't label anybody, really. Just love people for who they are, and shit, go on with your own life. That was our concern. I'm just trying to live my life. I got Crohn's, colitis, cancer, died twice, and came back. If anybody wants to talk about me and think I'm gay, that's wonderful. I don't care what they think of me. I'm just a human being trying to live day by day. And I had people think I was a man because I had a deep voice. Can you imagine? You know, it's just ridiculous, right? They think I have a penis, that's great. You know, they think I have a whatever, that's wonderful. It's what I think that matters.
Yeah.
And if you're not hurting anyone else, just be you. Fuck everyone else if they want to be that rude and ignorant and worry about you. They have no life to. I hung around drag queens. Jesus, jumping. I probably sound like one now. Anyway, that's what I get today. I'm so, I'm me, and I'm things rub off on me. People rub off on me. Really, seriously. So someone said, "You remind me of something." I was afraid to ask, really. But this was a gay woman. And I said, "Is it a drag queen?" She said, "Yes!" Well, I used to hang around with a lot of drag queens. It rubs off on you. So even though I'm a heterosexual woman, people either think I have my sex changed because of my voice, you know, or I have a penis, or I'm this or that and the next thing. For God's sake, they should worry about themselves.
Kevin.
Why worry about me?
Thank you. Nobody is better at being you than you. I know this from personal experience. But Judy, I'm gonna give it back to the other folks who are up here and want to talk.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, oh my God, no. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your contribution. So, Dan, you were ready.
I was wondering if, before we go, if Rebecca's up to it. Rebecca has just done a huge historical piece for the coast, spent months doing research and stuff. Rebecca, are you in a position to say a few words about the piece and about...
Yeah, I'm supposed to be doing a second draft right now. Sorry.
Hi. Hello. Hi.
I don't know which way to face
that. Okay, hello, hi. My name is Greg Rose, and I am a freelance writer. I took my MC. And just trying not to put my bum towards anyone. And yeah, I just did a piece for The Coast. It's going to come out on Thursday. It's focused on the 1970s because we have such a rich queer trans history in this city and this province. So it's 1970s. Gay and lesbian community and activism, and specifically looking at how that generation of activists, so Lynn and Robin and Jim, I see folks here who are around then, are our first generation of activist elders. And so while there were definitely gay folks before the folks here, this is the first generation that were activists, because the first group, the Gay Alliance for Equality, was founded in 1972. So I've tried to talk to folks that are here, but also folks that you might not know about, and people who have moved away. So I don't know if anyone in the room knows Chris Shepherd, who's the DJ at the Tread, who's an African Nova Scotia man. I've talked to Rich Childs. I've talked to Nancy Brister, who came out in the early 70s, and so yeah, that'll come out on Thursday.
Wow.
Yeah, and right now it's over 7,000 words, and it needs to be less.
However, we're hoping that all of the words, all 7,000 words or 70,000 words or whatever it takes, are all going to make it into the big encyclopedia. So hopefully all of that work is going to be available for people to check out.
All right. Tuma,
The other thing that I wanted to also point out, too, is that I'm not sure what has changed, and this is a change that I've noticed. In the early 80s, or in the late 80s, too, also mid-80s, early 80s, whenever you came to a place, you seemed to be part of a camaraderie. I didn't want to use fraternity in a way, right? Because one of the things I was, when I was at UBC, they wanted me to join a sorority. And I'm like, I was a little puzzled about that. But anyways, like for example, we knew each other who was gay and who was lesbian, and you knew it in some ways. Like, for example, one time I had a difficult time dealing with bureaucrats in trying to get a pamphlet published on HIV and AIDS for folks that we would distribute in for folks involved in street prostitution, right? Because the woman said, I don't think we should be publishing something like that here, right? So I wandered up the street, and I found this, and I thought, there's this gay man that I know, and I said, let me call him up. I know he's kind of high up, and he was the chief of staff for Premier at the time. And I went to his office, and I said, you know, me and you were dancing at Romer's the other night. I said, I'm kind of having this pamphlet I need to be published. Leave it with me. I have 500 pamphlets, but he said, he had to push. Even stuff like that. Or when you went into a restaurant, I remember having the best Caesar salad at the hotel Delta Barrington, because the waiter was like, all of a sudden he noticed that I was there, and we had seen each other in rooms. We never really talked or anything. He came over, took my order, winked at me, and I said, oh, okay, you know, you're like, okay. And he served me with the best Caesar salad ever. And even at banks or anything like that, you got an extra service. For example, if you're flying on airplanes and you knew who the steward was, you know, he said, oh, you know, and I had this conversation came up with another friend of mine. He said, you know, oh, I'm going to use my name instead, but it wasn't me. He said, when he was flying from Costa Rica up to Florida, you know, the steward was, I looked at him and I said, yeah, Mr. Young, we made a mistake on your ticket. You have to come up to first class. We don't seem to get that anymore. We're treated all equally, which doesn't mean we're not treated quite special. And in some ways, that's what we had at Rumors. You know, we all treated each other, we all helped out each other, and even in street air. You know, I never felt any difficulty walking home from Rumors all the way up to Galleon Street. But I knew a few non-black folks who would not walk it. They would skip around, they would go to Argonne to get to the Lavender District or something like that. They would not walk through here. And yes, there was no problem. I knew because Michael and Dan one time, the folks at ACA, they walked me home one time when we were walking, and they kissed on the corner, and they were jumped by folks. Because they kissed, right? No, that's the kind of stuff that happened, right? It's a different time now, but I kind of wonder if we can get that specialness back between each other a little bit more. And it's the same in the Lima community. If I walk into a place, and like in Hell Canada, and I'm trying to advocate for somebody or anything like that, I would search out who's the Mi'kmaq person here. The other thing that I find about Galligan Street here is that a lot of the organizations have left.
Right.
When I was here and I had the Atlantic First Nation East Asport, it was on street level here on Galligan Street. Even though we were for First Nations communities, we dealt with everyone that walked.
Hired me. My first job.
Yeah. And we gave a lot of opportunities to folks, you know. And we gave up. It was for us to even get something like difficulty like condoms. You know, how can you talk about AIDS without condoms? Why, you know, literally, we had to go get prescriptions at the North End Clinic, take them to the drugstore, and get them filled. I mean, the druggist was like, one gross of condoms? Come on, come on. Right? And then he warned me, he says, if you're giving these out, you're not supposed to be giving out prescriptions. You can get into trouble. I'm like, what the fuck am I going to do? Right? No, we need to get these things out. Other areas of the city, you talked about the other areas, I was thinking about Trollope Street, Summer Street.
Yeah.
Now, after the triangle, it wasn't cruise, it was also male prostitution.
Yeah. Yes.
They moved up to Trollope, Citadel Hill.
Yes.
They tried to close Citadel Hill in the early 1990s, but there was such an outcry from Halifax City Council. Why? I don't know why. Is it possible that politicians were up there? I don't know why they were up there. I mean, the museum's closed at night and it's too freaking dark. But if they didn't find anybody, they went down and visited the men on Trollope on Summer Herbert Street. And that's a part of our community. Sometimes when we think about how broad Pride has come and, you know, we march and everything like this, sometimes in our, I don't know how you probably say it, I'm probably going to say it wrong and anything like that, but how, in our quest to normalize, we lose a part of our foundational. Sex is very much part of it, and maintaining positive sex, and in the time of AIDS was very difficult to make sure that, yes, we are gay, yes, we are going to have sex. Don't tell me to stay abstinent. How do I have sex without infecting myself? No. How do we make sex fun? That was a major part of it. And even yesterday at the Truro Pride Parade, wonderful, I never thought I would see it. And we had a First Nation contingent. We had over, like, I think there was about 20 First Nations people there marching in that pride parade. I haven't seen them anywhere else. I mean, except in Toronto, when we left, I was the Grand Marshal of the Toronto Pride Parade there for the whole Toronto Two-Spirited Group. However, I also noticed that they came to me and they said one of the requirements for the Pride Parade in Truro was they had to check for clothing that was family friendly. And I'm like, yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know what the hell that was. Family friendly. I'm like, traditional Native men wore loincloths, for God's sake. I mean, what are you talking? Is it that assless, chapless thing again?
That would be Dan's fault.
I don't know where that
is. Dan McKay may be able to speak on
the assless chapless. Or is it women not allowed to be bare-breasted in the bride parade? We're forgetting that one of our common is that the joy of sex. The joy of homosexual sex, the joy of lesbian sex, the joy of trans sex, is the joy of sex that we need to also not to forget. We need to celebrate it, not just tolerate it.
Well, I love ending on the note of celebrating the joy of sex. I'll let you know, we got to like one tiny fraction of the things that I had notes for possible jumping off points for conversation. So there may be every opportunity to have this again, maybe on an annual basis with a different group of people. So I want to thank all of you for coming out and for taking part in, you know, whatever this shaped up to be, and we'll see kind of where this conversation grows from here. It's not the first and only time anyone's ever looked at queer history in Halifax, but I think experimenting with this kind of large conversation format is kind of interesting. So I hope you found it interesting as well. I want to thank Jen and Michael, Hugo, Rosie, Dan, Robin, Tuma, and Lynn for taking the time to speak with us so eloquently and so enjoyably. I love all you people. So thanks for all being in the same room with me and answering some questions. I want to say a quick thanks to Halifax Pride for its work on the God Industry Gathering and for the Queer X Theater Festival for hosting us in the bus stop here.